This podcast is intended for investment professionals. Hello and welcome back to Elgem Talks. This is our series In Conversation With, where we're profiling people from across the business of what brought them to asset management. I'm joined today by James Carrick, Global Economist. Thanks so much for being here, James.
Thank you.
So I'd like to start like very much right at the beginning of what drove you to be an economist. Was it at school? Was it at university? Where did this interest in the world and economics come from?
Yes, so I actually wanted to be a computer programmer. Mm-hmm. And most of my teenage years, I was programming computer games. I won a prize for that. But then my dad lost his job when I was a teenager in the early 1990s recession. Mm-hmm. And so I think this fascination of what makes booms and busts, yeah, and also a desire to ultimately work for the government to kind of stop the politicians messing the world up again really, really motivated me, having to see what problems can be caused at a family level from economic mismanagement.
So you really kind of assigned the policy, connected the policy to the economic outcome that you saw at home.
Yeah, so I don't know if you remember Harry Enfield and Loads of Money. At end of the late 80s, it was a boom, and the politicians, Nigel Lawson, thought that he'd cured the world. And then we had a big rise in inflation, a big rise in interest rates, and then we went bust.
This interest in kind of politics, I imagine that had a very much a historical bent as well, of kind of trying to build a picture of politics, of course, requires a knowledge of what came before. And at that time, there is, you know, so much history of British history being made in those decades. Am I right in thinking of a conflation of politics, economics and history really kind of interested you at the time at A level, would I say?
Yeah, I mean, GCSE, I enjoyed history, and A level, I did politics, economics, and maths. Mm. So, yeah, I mean, my job as an economist, economics has always been in the middle of that. You need mathematics, you need politics, you know, look at Trump and look at Brexit. You have to combine all of those different skills. And so, yeah, economics really was the focal point of those. That said, I did enjoy business studies GCSE. I remember saying to my teachers I wanted to do that at A level, and they said, no, you should be doing economics. But I really would have probably wanted to have done computer programming, but that wasn't a course offered at my school.
So I'd like to combine this. So what is it about computer programming that really appealed to you and that you took and applied to your later development in through education and through your work?
I think it's partly the logic. I mean, part of my job as an economist, as an econometrician, is using statistical software. It is manipulating data. It's a similar logical process to how you program a computer. I mean, maybe it's you just enjoy playing games, so you enjoy making games. But I think there's also a love of logic. I mean, I like maths, I like computers, so they go together as well.
So it's, if I'm understanding this right, within a framework, it's about understanding how things work, almost in an engineering perspective of kind of taking all these constituent parts to be able to create this model of whether it is the world, whether it is this computer game that you're creating through a defined code, a defined logic of ways about it.
That's very interesting and insightful. Mm. So I do actually recall now, when I was doing my A-levels, somebody gave me a computer model of the economy on a disk, and you could play around with fiscal policy, play around with monetary policy. In other words, you could be the politicians. And actually, it's funny just talking to you brings these things back, actually.
Yeah.
Going back to when I was younger, I played games like Civilization, and you had to choose, you know, guns or butter. Do you develop your economy, or do you go for the military victory? I always went for the economic victory. I evolved the economy until I developed nuclear weapons and I would smite out the enemies. And even when I was younger, I was playing a game called Railroad Tycoon, where you had to build the railways.
Yeah.
And there was this thing called interest rates and bonds, and I never really understood what was going on. But I knew that in recessions, the price of land was cheaper, and then you'd borrow, and then interest rates would go up. So I was learning business just by playing this game called Railroad Tycoon.
And I imagine that's what really fueled this kind of business management, of really understanding how the finances help a company work, but also the company exists within a larger model of an economy, a state economy, and then a global economy, right?
Yes, I think it's about understanding how things work. So when I've done these personality tests, it shows that I like data, and, and one of my skills is seeing patterns in data. So maybe when I was growing up, I was seeing patterns, even though I didn't know what this concept of interest rates and recession and land prices were. I sussed out how the game worked. I also love to play football management games, and you like to, you know, find out the cheap players.
Who are you trading? What for? What price? What what's their potential?
So I mean, not necessarily skilled to asset management. It's about getting a portfolio of cheap players who can do well and win things, what combinations work, and so, but I think it's seen in mathematical space as to what is attractive and what isn't attractive, and as you said, how things work. I think it's basically, in simple terms, trying to reverse engineer the there is an underlying spreadsheet, an underlying model in all of these computer games, and it's trying in your head to reverse engineer that. And yes, on a bigger picture, it's trying to reverse engineer how the world works.
And so, to take this back to kind of your education and into the workforce as well, you studied economics and then went straight into the Treasury, am I right?
Yeah, so it's actually interesting. My dream job when I was a teenager was to work for the government to kind of, you know, put a stop to boom and bust. But when I was at university, my lecturer really wanted me to stay in academia.
Yeah.
And you know, often you are influenced by who you are with. So when I was at university, I wanted to stay in academia. As I said, my father was unemployed. I had a modest background. I didn't want to spend another summer in another dead-end job working 70 hours a week. And so working for the Treasury, they promised to pay you to do a master's degree if you worked for them for 2 years.
Wow.
So actually, by the time I joined the Treasury, it was mainly because they would pay for my master's. And I thought, you'd live like a king. Imagine you're on a salary going back to university.
Yeah.
To me, that was like such a blessing.
Oh, I'm sure. Was the master's in economics as well a further field?
It would have been. I never actually got round to doing it because I only lasted a year in the government before I, quote, sold my soul to the devil and worked for the private sector.
Well, you know, we're very lucky to have you. But I know you didn't come straight to Legal & General after that. So you went to ABN AMRO to become an economist there, am I right?
Well, I actually went to ABN AMRO for interview practice. I got a phone call from a headhunter, and I'd never even heard of ABN AMRO. And I went for interview practice and, well, it seemed to go quite well.
Yeah.
I was frustrated at the Treasury. You see, I had this perception that being an independent analyst, you could give advice to the minister. In fact, before I joined the government, I got pretty much every episode of Yes Minister.
Oh, well, and, you know, Humphrey Appleby is an inspiration to us all, I'm sure.
So ministers come and ministers go, but the civil servants are in charge. And that was my perception. But what's fascinating is under the Blair-Brown government, the UK political system changed. I can't say what it was before, but we adopted the more American system whereby we appointed special advisors.
Yeah.
So the most senior economist within the civil service did not have Gordon Brown's ear. Mm. Instead, it was Ed Balls who he appointed. And so what was interesting was that as a civil servant, I spent most of my time defending this government's track record vis-a-vis the previous administration's track record. You were being a bureaucrat. Mm-hmm. You were not being an independent analyst.
Exactly. You're very much given the task to carry out, perhaps with economic and political aims balled into one.
I'd say political aims chiefly.
your driver of going into the government, of being able to, you know, prevent the cycle of boom and bust, was perhaps thwarted in that sense. Have I understood that right?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, one of my main jobs was to, obviously, can't say exactly what I was doing, but was to work out how much money the government could afford to spend, whether that was the right amount of money the government should be spending at that particular time is not the case.
The policy decisions were taken
policy,
out of
your
hand.
It was not economics, it was politics.
Exactly. So I feel like that you went through a very, very dramatic change in your view to not just economics, but like how the world works in that sense, with politics and economics intercolliding in your personal, professional life.
Mm-hmm.
That how has that helped your view of the world, this underlying spreadsheet, as you so eloquently put it, changed over that time since the Blair-Brown years to now?
Well, you learned a few tricks when you worked for the government. The first thing they told you in the government is don't trust any time the government says we're going to make savings due to inefficiencies or tax avoidance. And every time you see it in the Italian budget just released, mm-hmm. you see it in UK budgets, oh, we're going to spend lots of money or cut taxes, but we'll make up for it due to tax avoidance. Yes. And apparently that story's been going on for decades, yeah. if not centuries.
Because it's a very easy thing to promise. I mean, it's such a wonderfully high-level thing to say there are efficiencies somewhere and someone can always find a bureaucratic £1,000 on paperclips or something so ridiculously extravagant, and yet, you know, that does not add up to the significant savings versus the spending that's being promised, if I'm reading that correctly.
Yes. So it's about learning some of the spin that a government will say to you.
Which informs your work now perfectly well. As you were saying, looking at the Italian budget, looking at the forward projections through, you know, these reams of data that you're receiving, understanding what's optimism and what's realism, I imagine, is a very key part of your job today.
Yes, so you can become more sceptical because you understand, you know, exactly how the sausage is made in the sausage factory and whether you should be eating it or not. Exactly.
Yeah, absolutely. Is that something that you particularly enjoy about your role? Is like really having taking a lot of your knowledge of how the sausage is made and applying to that, and you know, manipulating this data. There's a piece that you and I worked on actually last year, which was demographic on the drivers of demographics of all these countries and their aging populations. I was so impressed when you just pulled off the World Bank data and manipulated it all to show the exact countries and exact ways that that you wanted to be able to show it. And I'll admit that my Excel skills are nowhere near as good. Is that really what drives you in what gets you up in the morning on a Monday morning to come into work?
I think I was inspired by my econometrics professor at university, who was one of two people who, in the early 1980s, came up with the theory of spurious correlations. And he basically showed that it's very easy to get two series showing a correlation with each other, yeah. but it's spurious. So again, which, you know, teaching me how the world works. And the other thing, I like to collect data, as you said, and manipulate data, because the other thing that he taught me was you can have the most complicated econometric model in the world, but if you're using bad quality data, it's going to be useless. Mm-hmm. The most important thing is to get good quality, clean data. And the analogy I give is making a meal. If you have, you know, chicken and whatever meat that's a bit off, you can put it in a nice fancy sauce and you can make it a bit more edible. But if you have a high quality steak, and apologies to all vegan listeners, if you have a high quality steak, you don't need any fancy cooking. You put it on a pan, you turn it over, and it tastes nice. Mm. And I think that's what I've always tried to work towards, is getting high quality data. Yeah.
High quality data in, high quality results out.
Yes.
Would be perhaps the simplistic equation to think of that in. But where is that high quality data? How are you judging this high quality data? Well, is it a case of primary sources? Are there sources of data that you trust more? Or is it more that it's presented in ways that that make sense to you, that fit to your view?
I think one of the skills I've shown is a perseverance to hunt for data and to try to kind of create long-term time series. I remember going to a very fascinating seminar at the Bank of England, and they said that their model of the UK economy did not predict the financial crisis, did not predict the recession. Mm-hmm. And they said that this model was estimated from about 1993 to the mid-2000s. There was no recessions in the UK during that period. And therefore, how can a model of an economy predict recessions when it's never seen a recession? Yeah. So you have to try to get data that goes back in time that observes the thing that you're trying to predict. So I think one of the key points in my career was at the end of 2007, a model was showing a recession in the United States. And it was collating through various channels a series of lending conditions from US banks that went back to the 1960s. Mm-hmm. And every time it had deteriorated, signaled a recession. And the housing market was wobbling, and yep. you'd seen a few banks going bust, and it was sending a red alert. And so we didn't know how bad the recession was going to be, but the risks were all one way.
Exactly. It's not that there were still these red flags coming up to you through the data that you were looking at.
Yeah, and I think that's actually what one of the important skills of an economist is. We discussed having mathematics as a background, mm-hmm. having politics as a background, and economics being the middle. So it is easy just to kind of not look at the numbers and just have a strong view. You know, this is going to be a recession, it's going to be not. But similarly, you can be too mathematical and not understand how the world works. There were some quants at ABN AMRO who were modelling US house prices for some of the loans that they were selling to investors. And their model said there's never been a nationwide fall in house prices. Ergo, everything's fine. And it's like, well, if you look at other countries, so you expand your data set, mm-hmm. there's been falling prices. And you look at what was going on with like condoflip.com, where people were buying properties off plan and then flipping them. You know, again, economics, we were taught about bubbles.
Yeah.
So I think you cannot be purely a mathematician. I've seen examples of that. Mm-hmm. Similarly, I wouldn't say you can be completely theoretical. You have to look at some of the data. And I think, I'm not saying predicting the world is easy. It's extremely hard. But combining those skills can help.
So I think this, what you've just described, it is very, very complex. And of course, why many fund managers do employ economists. To take a slightly left turn, how would you explain such a complicated role and a way of going about things to someone like your son?
Well, the most common question we get asked as economists is, should I get a fixed or variable rate mortgage? You won't believe the number of times. I mean, interest rates have been dead for so long, so that's less of a question. But again, what mortgage do I get? So most people understand that the basic role of an economist is, what's the Bank of England going to do?
Yeah.
And to other people who don't have an understanding of interest rates, you basically say, well, it's when is unemployment going to go up and what's going to happen to prices? People understand those concepts.
Yeah.
If we correctly anticipate that interest rates are going up and then somebody else hasn't, and so it's a relative winner, relative loser. The way I put it is, protecting your client's money. So we know in 2007, Northern Rock did a rights issue. I was like, what the heck? This is a bubble?
Yeah.
But, you know, some people would have bought those, but others you're trying to say, well, put your money in cash or you know, maybe gold because the banks are, you know, but be careful. But actually the way I see it now is more the relationship between borrowers and lenders, or those with money and those without. But actually, something I read very recently in Why Nations Fail, it said that in the 1800s, most of the US inventors didn't have much money. They had primary schools education, but they were able to raise finance from banks.
Mm.
So if you imagine another world where the only people who could innovate were the traditional landowners with capital, and if you were a poor person with lots of ideas, you never had any chance to innovate, you wouldn't have had the likes of Thomas Edison and what have you.
So does that help inform your view of when you're looking at, you know, banks' willingness to lend as a key driver of economic growth? Do you tie these disparate, what seem to me as disparate measures, together in your view of the world?
I think I use that, the willingness of banks to lend is more of a cyclical indicator for recessions. But when we were talking about quantitative easing and the very low interest rates, there were two different scenarios of what could happen. One is that it props up zombie companies. Mm-hmm. And it's ironic because I'm going to go to Tesco after this and get a meal deal. But Tesco, we know, got those out-of-town big shopping malls. And they were selling TVs and DVD players and what have you in these out-of-town centres. And then the internet came and nobody goes to those out-of-town centres to buy, you know, clothes and TVs and what have you. You buy them from Amazon.
Giant superstores perhaps being somewhat overburdened by the weight of real estate that they've taken on.
Yes, so there is some argument to say that Tesco should have gone bust when it got downgraded. Mm. It had overexpanded. It should have been forced to shrink. Mm. And you would have liked the likes of Amazon and Ocado would have a much bigger market share today. Mm-hmm. And we would be much more efficient.
Yeah.
So you've been propping up zombie companies. But the alternative was when you had oil at $100 and you had zero interest rates, you had to have had the shale revolution.
Yeah.
Because you just had such an imbalance between the cost of capital and the rate of return on capital.
Exactly. It's not necessarily that the shale revolution had to happen. It's more that just something had to happen because the way the scales were balanced was so out of whack.
Yeah, so I think the key therefore is the extent to which low interest rates props up existing companies, mm-hmm. which may or may not want to innovate, versus provided capital to new companies that can innovate. And to be honest, that's a very difficult concept for me, because we need creative destruction. We need these mm-hmm. new companies to come through. But of course, governments don't want that because you get localized losses. And as I said, growing up, you know, my father lost his job. And so you understand what happens mm-hmm. when unemployment hits. But if you know, we would all be riding horses and maybe my job would be cleaning, you know, horse manure off the streets if we didn't have the internal combustion engine.
Mm, the political becomes the personal.
Yes.
And the economics becomes the personal in that sense. And I imagine that's so much of where your role in an investment management firm, because, of course, you could be an economist anywhere, essentially. Yeah, you could go back to academia. But within an investment management firm, it's very much that you are providing your views to be implemented. And I think that's so fascinating that you can have that tangible impact as you were looked for in the Treasury. Here in a fund management business, and that your views do inform key investment decisions which drive client returns.
Absolutely. So a couple of examples. I mean, the main one, as I said, was calling the recession in 2007-08, mm-hmm. allowing fund managers to de-risk, mm-hmm. preserve our clients' capital. And more recently, as seen in the podcast I gave with Viral mm. on China, by analysing to what extent is China copying, mirroring some of the fast growth track that Korea, Japan and Taiwan did and continue mm-hmm. to grow, allows Viral to say, well, China Mobile is not priced for China to continue to become a richer country like those. And if it was, there's huge upsides to the valuation of each Chinese mobile subscriber.
So presenting these opportunities to fund managers who can then, you know, implement that in a strategic and tactical sense.
Yeah, so if my desire is to understand how the world works, and when you've seen some high conviction views as to where the world is likely to evolve, then you can spot opportunities at markets at different points in time.
Well, I think that's a really fascinating note to end on. Thank you so much, James, for really kind of drawing out what drove you into economics, your political interests, historical interests, and really what drives you in your work today for Legal & General Investment Management. Thanks so much for being here, James.
Thank you very much.
And thanks to you for listening. If you'd like to find out more about James's writings, be sure to visit our blogs, Future World Blog and Macro Matters. Thank you so much to our wonderful producer Holly McNulty, and thanks to you for listening. See you next week. If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, you can leave us a rating or maybe even a review if you're feeling particularly generous on the Apple Podcasts app. It really helps new listeners to find us, and we're always on the lookouts for new ways we can improve. As a reminder, this podcast is intended for investment professionals and shouldn't be shared with a non-professional audience. This podcast should not be taken as an invitation to deal in legal and general investments. Any views expressed during this recording belong to the individuals and are based on market conditions at the time of recording and do not reflect the views of Legal & General Investment Management. Legal & General Investment Management is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. For full terms and conditions, please visit our website. And remember to share this podcast with your investment professional friends, colleagues, or even family members. And to find more great content from Legal & General Investment Management, check us out on Twitter, LinkedIn, and our website.